Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 26. Up first is Steve Ambler writing on why the carbon tax was never worth the cost.
The federal carbon tax is set to increase on April 1 from $65 per ton of carbon dioxide or CO2 equivalent to $80 per ton, on its way to a planned $170 per ton by 2030. The planned increase is, to say the least, controversial, with seven provincial premiers calling on the Liberal government to cancel the increase, with opposition leader Pierre Poilievre promising to axe the tax, and with the Saskatchewan government refusing to collect the tax and remit it to Ottawa. Economists deserve the credit, or the blame, for the idea of a carbon tax as a means of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. What, in fact, does economics have to say about the current and future levels of the carbon tax? There is agreement among most economists that a carbon tax is potentially the most efficient way to reduce emissions. There is also agreement among many economists that, as the saying goes, the devil is in the details. For this economist, the details are the current level of the carbon tax is very likely already too high compared to the net costs of greenhouse gas emissions. It has been implemented in the most inefficient way possible. Emissions are a global problem, and Canada by itself can make a negligible contribution to reducing emissions. And the carbon tax is hurting the competitiveness of Canadian companies in domestic and foreign markets. Understanding the reasoning for these conclusions means being able to make informed decisions at the ballot box and informed criticisms of proposed policies. The logic of a carbon tax is straightforward. Even if an individual is as well off after an increase in the carbon tax, for example, because of a rebate, he or she still has an incentive to substitute goods or activities with less emissions which are relatively cheaper because of the tax. The goal is to achieve net zero, where an economy either has no emissions or offsets them, by 2050. This stems from the Paris Agreement signed at the UN's COP21 conference in 2015. The ultimate goal is to limit the increase in the average global temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius above its pre-industrial level. This goal will be very hard to attain, mainly because it is very difficult to reduce some types of emissions. Think heating a house with a heat pump using renewable electricity in minus 20 degrees Celsius weather with no sun and no wind. Bjorn Lomborg, head of the Copenhagen Consensus Institute, has calculated, using one of the United Nations' own models, that all policies from the Paris Agreement would likely reduce global temperature rise about 0.17 degrees Celsius in 2100, an impact which would be imperceptible. The conclusion must be that the net zero goal is suboptimal. The only economist to win a Nobel Prize for work in environmental economics, William Nordhaus of Yale University, argued that a target of 3.5 degrees would balance costs and benefits, and that doing nothing at all would be better than trying to hit a target of 1.5 degrees. Rather than attempting more than a very modest mitigation of temperature increases, adaptation to warming is better. The economic justification for a carbon tax is that emissions cause harms that are not included in the prices of the goods produced using technologies that emit greenhouse gases. With a carbon tax, the total price reflects the total social cost of emissions. Almost all estimates of the social cost take into account only the predicted harmful effects of CO2, using models that have systematically overstated its warming effects. They neglect the well-established positive impact of CO2 on plant growth, which has led to a greening of the earth and an increase in agricultural productivity estimated to be worth over $3 trillion between 1961 and 2011. A recent study of the social cost of CO2 accounts for this effect and gives a range of estimates lower than the current carbon tax, and in some cases the estimated social costs are actually negative. If this is indeed the case, then the argument follows that we should be subsidizing rather than taxing the use of fossil fuels. Regardless, though, if the goal is to efficiently reduce emissions, the carbon tax should be used alone. Piling on other taxes, subsidies, regulations, and controls increases the cost of cutting emissions because they introduce distortions into the operation of markets. The current policy mix has many of these, including but not limited to mandates on zero-emission vehicles, massive subsidies for the production of batteries for electric vehicles, carbon tax exemptions for heating oil but not for other types of home heating, and total bans on some uses of plastic. It almost seems guaranteed to maximize the cost of reducing emissions. If greenhouse gases are a problem, they're a global problem. Canada can do nothing by itself to solve it. If the Canadian economy were to disappear tomorrow, the increase in emissions from China, which is building 2 new coal-fired power plants per week, would more than make up for the elimination of Canadian emissions within months. The Climate Tracker Action Organization assesses that in February 2024, no countries are meeting their Paris Agreement targets. Many countries, including Canada, are either highly or critically insufficient. If going it alone is futile, the carbon tax is punishing Canadian firms in an important way. It hurts their competitiveness with imports from firms that face a lower carbon tax and when exporting to markets served by those firms. It is possible, but administratively costly, to implement border adjustments that tax the imports from jurisdictions with a lower carbon tax and which wholly or partially exempt the tax on exports to such jurisdictions. There have been discussions about implementing these adjustments, but so far they have not borne fruit. The bottom line? Pause increases in the carbon tax permanently and have a serious discussion about eliminating the hodgepodge of rules and regulations that are harming the efficiency and competitiveness of the Canadian economy.
That was a commentary by Steve Ambler. He is a professor emeritus of economics at Université du Québec à Montréal. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. In the coming months, Canadian digital news outlets will be able to fund up to 50% of their journalists' salaries through one form of government-coordinated subsidy or another. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality news and analysis that is independent is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join now at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by Matt Spoke, writing on why Doug Ford risks letting down a generation of Ontarians and losing the next election in the process.
Guns blazing might have been the best way to describe Doug Ford at the beginning of his term as premier in 2018. Among many policy priorities at the time, his ardent supporters seemed most excited by his willingness to shake up Toronto politics forever by cutting the size of city council in half and giving strong powers to the office of mayor, both incredibly controversial moves that had him labeled as an enemy of democracy. Although those two policies were very welcomed by conservatives because they aimed to dramatically reduce gridlock at Toronto City Hall, it was really the temperament behind these moves that stood out most. We finally had a leader in Ontario who wasn't afraid to kill sacred cows in his efforts to make the province function again. Political consequences be damned. Today, in 2024, that version of Premier Ford doesn't seem to exist anymore. Instead, in the midst of a severe national housing crisis, disproportionately caused by decades of bad policy in Toronto and Ontario, Ford is choosing to prioritize the status quo. Although no leader wants to govern through a crisis, this one presented a unique opportunity for a conservative premier in Canada's largest province. Long before Pierre Poilievre became the champion of housing in Canada, the mantle was Ford's for the taking. After all, Ford is the premier who first started talking about the need to accelerate housing completions in Canada, a big part of the motivation behind his dramatic moves to change Toronto City Council. The premier who appointed an ambitious housing affordability task force to make recommendations to the province on immediate actions to take, and the premier who has published several significant pieces of housing legislation since coming into office. But in all of this, he's refused to go beyond words. It is more expensive today to build housing in Toronto than when Ford became premier. The long-awaited Housing Task Force report has substantively been collecting dust on a shelf. The housing legislations that have passed in Ontario have had marginal, if any, effect on housing completions. And last week, Ford has reaffirmed his NIMBY credentials by shutting down a proposal that would have allowed gentle intensification of neighborhoods across the province, a policy that is now supported by provincial Liberals, Greens, and NDP. In 2021, Ford's government announced its target to see 1.5 million new homes built in Ontario by 2031, a target that may still be too low when factoring in recent immigration trends. Very quickly, the real estate development industry concluded that the target was effectively impossible to reach without immediate and incredibly substantial changes to land use policies, many of which were recommended in Ford's own Housing Affordability Task Force report. To date, almost 3 years into this 10-year time frame, no such substantial policies have been enacted, and the province is well behind its target of 150,000 new homes per year. To get ahead of their obvious underperformance, they're now starting to add long-term care beds and finished basement units in their math for housing completions. Although not a comprehensive solution to the crisis, this past week's announcement that Ford would never support fourplexes in neighborhoods across the province demonstrated that he is unwilling to make the difficult, and sometimes politically unpopular, in decisions needed to address the magnitude of this housing crisis. Next week, along with the province's budget, we expect to hear from Ford's Housing Minister, Paul Calandra, on the government's renewed housing policy agenda, but already the rumors are circulating that Calandra's housing ambitions have been significantly watered down since going to cabinet and the premier for approval. All of this has been disappointing to watch unfold. Today I write this piece reluctantly. I once held this government and this premier in high regard, and I continue to be a card-carrying member of the PC party. But now, more importantly, I'm a member of an overlooked generation. I'm 36 years old, I have 2 children, and I live in Toronto. The cards are getting stacked against Ontarians like me.
That was a commentary by Matt Spoke. He is a Canadian tech entrepreneur and founder of Moves. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.